As we go through apologetics, we start with the origin of the universe in the Big Bang, which is the cosmological argument. Then we get to the teleological argument. This comes from the root telos, T-E-L-O-S, meaning purpose. And so this is the argument from design. You guys read on that this week. And then we're going to argue another form of the teleological argument, which is the origin of life. That there is design not just in the macro sphere of physics, but that there is design in the microscopic sphere of biology, really even down into the cell itself. So abiogenesis, the alpha privative means not, bios in Greek means life, and then genesis means to create. So to get non-life to be created into life, abiogenesis. Or what's called the origin of life topic. This is abbreviated to be OOL, OOL. You'll see that in the literature, origin of life. Let's think back historically on the origin of life. In the 1830s, biologists Matthias Schleiden and Theodor Schwann were both working independently of each other. This would be before Darwin's Origin of Species was published in 1859. And both of these biologists discovered that life is comprised of cells. What's interesting, though, is that when they observed the cell in 1830, they couldn't see it that well. They could see that it had a cell wall or membrane. They could see a nucleus in the center and a protoplasm. And here's their drawings from their primitive microscopes. They could see the cell, and that the cells made up all sorts of living organisms. And yet, to look at that kind of a cell, it just looks like kind of like a jelly sack. It looks like something more primitive that builds something more complex. And so this would really fit with Darwinism, when you think about it, that you have something, a cellular machine that is very primitive, like a sack of jelly, that creates more complex things like organs, which creates more complex things like organisms. Well, since then, we've discovered that as we get further and further into the cell, that this is way more complex than we ever imagined. In fact, each cell, living cell, is like a miniature city. It has a library, a police force, a fire department. I mean, right on down the line. We're being a little bit anthropomorphic here, where we're describing the cell like a machine, like a city, but really not that far off. And we've discovered that the cell isn't just complex like a snowflake, like it's complex, banging a bunch of keys on the piano. That's technically complex. But that there is a sense of specified complexity in the cell, meaning that it's not just complex or improbable, but it follows a certain independent pattern to create life. Think about amino acids and DNA. You need both of these to create cells. Amino acids are folded in certain patterns and they're arranged to create proteins. And depending on the formation and arrangement of amino acids, you get different types of proteins in the cell. DNA, on the other hand, is a molecule which gives information or instruction for amino acids. So the DNA is like the brain, the instructions, the library, and the amino acids are like the police force, the fire department, the ambulance, the university. But the amino acids are folded and arranged according to DNA. And DNA is created through amino acids. 1 gram of DNA can store 700 terabytes of data. So you think about, I remember when I used to use a floppy disk to save my papers. Just think about that. And then they upgraded. You could get a thumb drive. Whoa. Instead of having 256 megabytes, now you had a gigabyte. You could carry it around on your keychain. I remember getting a bunch of e-books and having it on my thumb drive and being like, I have the complete works of Francis Bacon, you know, or the complete works of whatever was public domain, you know, Bill Shakespeare on my thumb drive. And being like, wow, I've got all this information on this little thumb drive. okay, a terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes. On 1 gram of DNA, you can store 700 terabytes of data. So this is long before the thumb drive. Richard Dawkins, he says, the genetic code is truly digital in exactly the same sense as computer codes. That's interesting to consider. He's not saying that this is analogous, like it's like a computer code. He's saying it is one and the same, in his words, exactly the same as a computer code. The question is, how do you get information? You need a mind. Every time we have information, we have a mind which gives us information. To have information, you need an informer. You don't get that through random processes or really any kind of natural processes. Check out this video here, which shows the transcription of RNA.
When the RNA copy is complete, it snakes out into the outer part of the cell. Then, in a dazzling display of choreography, all the components of a molecular machine lock together around the RNA to form a miniature factory called a ribosome. It translates the genetic information in the RNA into a string of amino acids that will become a protein. Special transfer molecules, the green triangles, bring each amino acid to the ribosome. The amino acids are the small red tips attached to the transfer molecules. There are different transfer molecules for each of the 20 amino acids. Each transfer molecule carries a three-letter code that is matched with the RNA in the machine. Now we come to the heart of the process. Inside the ribosome, the RNA is pulled through like a tape. The code for each amino acid is read off, three letters at a time, and matched to three corresponding letters on the transfer molecules. When the right transfer molecule plugs in, the amino acid it carries is added to the growing protein chain. Again, you are watching this in real time. And after a few seconds, the assembled protein starts to emerge from the ribosome. Ribosomes can make any kind of protein. It just depends what genetic message you feed in on the RNA. In this case, the end product is hemoglobin. The cells in our bone marrow churn out 100 trillion molecules of it per second. And as a result, our muscles, brain, and all the vital organs in our body receive the oxygen they need.
So, just think about that for a second. That's happening in real time. The messenger RNA comes off of the DNA, goes into the ribosome, which is a factory, matches up the codons, the message, with amino acids, pumps those out, creates a replication, creates a new protein. In this case, it was hemoglobin. And this is happening trillions of times. And it is, for all intents and purposes, a factory that's producing this. Richard Dawkins, this is from his 96. I think this came out in 86. Blind watchmaker. He writes on page 116, he says, there's enough storage capacity in the DNA of a single lily seed or a single salamander sperm to store the Encyclopedia Britannica 60 times over. So some of the most primitive types of cells that we can find and appeal to, this could fit 60 encyclopedias. And I know you guys never used encyclopedias. You use Wikipedias. But encyclopedia, a whole set, they used to have salesmen that would sell these. It was a whole set, a massive amount of books, basically covering everything you'd want to know about anything. And it was 60 times this in a single seed or sperm. He says amoebas have as much information in their DNA as 1,000 Encyclopedia Britannicas. Paul Davies, who is an agnostic and may have moved over into deism. I really can't keep this straight where he's at in his worldview. In his book called The Eerie Silence, he refers to the cell as, quote, a supercomputer. And that's really not far from the mark. He's a guy who has studied origin of life. And to look at the cell, this really is a computer, truly a supercomputer, to be able to function and to move on such a microscopic level. We don't have anything currently, nanotechnology, nothing that is able to process information at this microscopic of a level. Now, some people would say, well, perhaps evolution can explain the origin of life, that you have simpler cells and then they compete for fitness to produce more complex cells and so on and so forth. False. That's what's so interesting about this topic of the origin of life. You need life in order for there to be neo-Darwinism. You need DNA. You need self-replicating cells to have competition, to have natural selection, to have mutation, all of the hallmarks of neo-Darwinism. And so to say that evolution can account for the origin of life is a huge mistake, patently false. In fact, Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, page 106 or 168, he says the origin of life, by contrast, lies outside the reach of evolution because natural selection cannot proceed without it. Yes, outside the reach. You can't have evolution without natural selection. You can't have natural selection, descent with modification, without living cells to mutate and to have natural selection select for those which are more fit. Theodosius Dobzhansky, who's a leading 20th century evolutionary biologist, he says, pre-biological natural selection is a contradiction in terms. That's right. Before you have life, we're going to have natural selection. It's a contradiction. Well, that's one difficulty here. Let's go through three of the main issues confronting origin of life researchers today. Number one, the difficulty, what's called the chicken and egg problem of proteins and DNA. In order to have proteins, you need DNA, but in order to have DNA, you need proteins. And so this is a chicken and egg difficulty. Which came first? In order to have chickens, you need eggs. In order to have eggs, you need chickens. And so that's kind of the idea, is which came first, the protein or DNA? So let's think about this for a second. Proteins. So amino acids form proteins, and we have multiple different types of proteins. For example, we have structural proteins. These build the cell walls. Whoa, that's important. Yeah, because if you don't have a membrane or a cell wall, then all of the proteins and material and DNA inside the cell will just go get dispersed with the rest of everything else in the atmosphere or in the water or on the land. You need a cell wall to make this distinct from everything else. So two, you need functional proteins. These are the ones that are transporting the materials, like we saw in that video. That when you have the DNA and then it turns into messenger RNA, that this is moving that through the ribosome, and we have amino acids that are being placed and copied, and these are producing new proteins, functional proteins to move the materials. You need that. Then you need regulatory proteins. For example, enzymes regulate chemical reactions. To unzip the DNA, you need a certain enzyme or enzymes to unzip it in order to get the code, the information, out of the DNA. Now, do you see the problem here? In order to have structural, functional, and regulatory proteins, you need information from DNA. But in order to get the information out of the DNA, you need structural, functional, and regulatory proteins. So which is it? DNA has the information to instruct and arrange protein assembly, but then proteins themselves protect DNA, they unzip the DNA, and they release the DNA to form messenger RNA, to create a new life-promoting cell. And so this is the first difficulty with origin of life research. The best explanation at the moment is that we don't start with DNA or proteins, but some kind of a primitive RNA world, which if you want some more material on that, this has been thoroughly critiqued. They aren't any closer on this than they were before. The more they study the idea of an RNA world, the more they realize this is just rife with problems. You cannot just have RNA floating out there. And it still doesn't give you information. I don't know how you get information from nothing without a mind. Number two, another problem with the origin of life is what's called the chirality of amino acids. The chirality of amino acids. You say, what's that? Chirality refers to the handedness. Amino acids are either left-handed or they're right-handed. And in order to have a certain string of amino acids, they all need to be a certain hand, either left-handed or right-handed. So literally what we're thinking about here is, if this is by chance, it's literally a flip of the coin to get a left-handed or a right-handed amino acid. And we're looking at strings of amino acids that are going on for 20, 40, 60, 80, 100, 200, 300, 400 long. So the odds of this coming up heads every time is astronomical. This would be like flipping a quarter 400 times in a row, even for a primitive protein or a primitive cell. 400 times in a row just to get that. Number three, we need what's called specified complexity. As I said before, many things are complex. Let me give you an example. 417-859-6487. Those numbers I just gave you, well, those are the numbers to a phone, cell phone. But I just made them up off the top of my head. Specified complexity would say, yeah, those numbers you gave, they're really complex. What are the odds that you would have picked those numbers over any other? What is that, 10 numbers I just said? 7 numbers plus the area code? What are the odds that you would have come up with those amount of numbers? Well, a million to one, millions to one, tens of millions to one. But we don't just need complexity, because I could rattle off any other string of numbers. That would be equally as complex. What we need is specified complexity. So let me give you an example. Your best friend goes up, you know, they're at the coffee shop, and they're looking for a job, and they bump into a person in their field. The person says to him, so what do you do for a living? And your buddy's like, well, you know, I'm a computer engineer and been looking for work. Huh, I own a computer company. What do you specialize in? Well, I specialize in this, that, and the other thing. Huh, that's exactly what I'm looking for. How much are you looking to get paid? And your friend's like, well, you know, 60 grand a year. The guy's like, that's exactly how much I want to pay. He says, okay, I'm going to give you my phone number. I want you to call me, and I'm going to set up an interview. You're a shoo-in. So the guy, right, you know, let's think prehistoric here. He pulls out a pen and paper, and he writes down the digits for his phone number. He hands it to your buddy. Both of you go home. You're like, that's unbelievable. You bump into this guy at a coffee shop. You're going to get a job, man, a career. That's great. The guy's like, yeah, I got to put this on my phone. So he reaches into his pocket. Oh, no. It's not in the front pocket. It's not in the back pocket. It's not, I don't have a pocket up here. I didn't wear a coat. Where's that number? And he's looking around for the number. He can't find it. He's not going to be able to contact this guy. And all of a sudden, you turn to your buddy and you say, dude, wait a minute. I got a phone right here. Okay, don't worry about this. All the numbers he gave you, I've got all those numbers on my phone. I got a 0. I got a 1. I got a 2. I got a 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I got those all right here. What's the problem with that? The problem isn't that we have all of the building blocks to make the phone call, the amino acids. We got all the numbers. That's not the problem. The problem is we need the right sequence of numbers. So specified complexity isn't just that it's complex, 10 million to 1. Like somebody's going to win the Powerball tomorrow, 100 million to 1, 300 million to 1. It's that you will win the Powerball tomorrow. It's not just that you're banging the keys of the piano. It's that you're playing Mozart or Bach. It's that you're following an independent pattern. In this case, it's astronomically complex and improbable, but it also fits the independent pattern for life to exist. So think about it like this. Think about it in the context of language. Somebody says, come on, let's go eat, man. And then somebody else writes this, come on, let's go eat, man. That'd be the difference between Anthony Hopkins in every movie and Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. Because just that one comma missing would lead to cannibalism. It's not just, let's go eat, my friend. Let's go eat, my friend. Let's go eat, man. The same thing is true with amino acids. If one of these is out of order, it's not just that we get a different form of life, like that illustration I just used. Well, you know, maybe you punch in a number into the phone and you don't get the computer guy, but maybe you get another guy on the phone. Okay, that's not the illustration. The illustration is you need to get that guy and that guy alone. And in fact, the improbabilities we're dealing with here so far outweigh what I was talking about there with the guy on the phone. It's a pittance. It doesn't even compare. What we have with life are 20 forms of amino acids. And arranging even a small sequence of amino acids with the right chirality, the right handedness, they're all right-handed, they're all left-handed, and in the right order, just to get an incredibly small sequence, like 150 amino acids. This wouldn't be any life on Earth, by the way. Nothing like, not even bacteria would fit this. Bacteria are parasitic on life. So even the most primitive life we can see on Earth, let's just go real small, 150 amino acids, getting them to be life-permitting. The chances of this being in the right order would be 10 to the 195th power. Now, when we look on Earth, some you know, origin of life people say, well, maybe the first cell, maybe it wasn't 150 amino acids, maybe it was 100 amino acids. Maybe it was 80, maybe it was 40, maybe it was 60, maybe it was 10. The question is, if it's so easy to get 10 amino acids together to create a protein and DNA and to make it self-replicating, why don't these exist today? Why, if it's so easy, why isn't the planet Earth teeming with these very primitive cells? They say things like, well, the atmosphere changed, the oceans changed, and so forth. But if these are so easy to produce, why wouldn't we see them all over the planet? Instead, what we find is even the simplest life, independent life, you need at least a sequence of 500. We're saying this is 150 amino acids and is still astronomically improbable. Conservative figures place the odds of a simple 100 amino acid string at 10 to the 63rd power or 10 to the 77th power. Remember, if you were to add up all of the protons, neutrons, and electrons in the material universe, that's 10 to the 80th power. So just to get the simplest conservative form of life you could get here, we're talking about numbers in this range. Dr. Klaus Dos, who's a biochemist, this is from 1988. Now I want you to see the history of this here. He said, more than 30 years of experimentation on the origin of life have led to a better perception of the immensity of the problem of the origin of life on Earth rather than to its solution. So after 3 decades of studying it, it's not that this gap has gotten smaller with time. No, the experimentation has increased. The explanations have decreased. He says, at present, all discussions on principal theories and experiments in the field either end in stalemate or in a confession of ignorance. James Shapiro, molecular biologist out of the University of Chicago, this is from 96, he says there are no detailed Darwinian accounts for the evolution of any fundamental biochemical or cellular system, only a variety of wishful speculations. Paul Davies, 1999, The Fifth Miracle, The Search for the Origin and Meaning of Life. This is his book on the topic. Davies writes, when I set out to write this book, I was convinced that science was close to wrapping up the mystery of life's origin. Having spent a year or two researching the field, I am now of the opinion that there remains a huge gulf in our understanding. This gulf in understanding is not merely ignorance about certain technical details. It is a major conceptual lacuna, a big hole, gaping hole, lacuna. More recently, 2010, Davies, he says, quote, the problem of life's origin is very far from being clearly formulated and nowhere near being solved. Franklin Herald, 2001, of all the unsolved mysteries remaining in science, the most consequential may be the origin of life. The origin of life is also a stubborn problem with no solution in sight. And we could read quotes like this, one after the other, after the other. They are no closer than they have been for the last 60 years. They thought they had a breakthrough with the Stanley-Urey experiment. Stanley Miller had put together methane and certain gases in a test tube and then electrified it, and he was able to create certain amino acids. And they said, so here we go. We've got the building blocks for life's origin. There was probably electricity, lightning, early primitive atmosphere on Earth, and so we got amino acids. It's incredible. Since then, they discovered that Stanley Miller, the chemicals he used, were not on the primitive earth. That's not what the primitive earth used. And even if they were, even if that is how you get amino acids does not explain the origin of life at all. And I mean that, I'm not being hyperbolic. I mean, that doesn't get you anywhere close. That's like me handing you the cell phone and saying, hey, I got all the numbers on my phone, all the amino acids. Now, yeah, we got the number figured out. You need the chirality to be explained. You need the chicken and egg problem to be explained. And you need the complexity and the specified complexity to be explained. Origin of life, in my estimation, an insuperable problem. On the other hand, if you believe that God exists, and according to Genesis 1:2, it says that the Spirit was hovering over the deep, over the waters. And that's interesting, because that's the word used in Deuteronomy for a mother hen, bird, hovering over her young. Hugh Ross makes a lot out of that. He says that perhaps the Spirit created the beginning of life to change the atmosphere and to start the early planet getting going. No, we're not any closer than we were before, and there's so many insuperable problems from a naturalistic perspective. Now, if you included, well, what if there was like a mind that could create this? That would be totally different. And if theism can explain this, I don't know why we would exclude that without any kind of a basis for it.